This is a reading of early lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Christian Mystery. This is lecture from the fourth section, lecture 4.1, entitled Paths of Initiation, The Three Paths of Initiation, given on September 19th, 1906 in Basel. When giving a public lecture on a Christian theme, it is impossible to speak of the Theosophical World Movement as intimately as it is in today's lecture to a more limited audience. In the following lecture, I will give a description of the three paths of initiation. Many of you have concerned yourselves, in various ways, with spiritual science and know many of the ideas of the Theosophical Movement. Through literature, lectures, and your own reflection, many of you have become interested in hearing more detailed descriptions of the supersensible, the eternal, what lies beyond the temporal, transitory world. Spiritual science has made it its task, in particular, to give teachings concerning the deeper essence of human beings and their place in the world, to research what is eternal and abiding in human beings. What are the goals and purposes of the world and the human being? Finally, how did the world arise? Today we will be concerned primarily with the paths to be taken if one wants to acquire insights into these higher questions. Human morality is the highest ideal we can set for ourselves. Universal community among all human beings is the ideal that all great and noble people have always set for themselves. The Theosophical Union wants the same. Never and nowhere has it intended to establish a new sect based on Buddhism, even less does it seek to eliminate or replace Christianity. Neither does it seek to bring anything unscientific. It is also important to distinguish between the teaching of Theosophy, or its worldview, and its goals, the creation of a universal community among all people. Both the theoretical and the practical sides of spiritual science are necessary. Knowing it should make us familiar with what is higher and the highest. To a certain extent, we work on our souls with such thoughts and prepare our souls for practical human love and community. The theoretical goal is to understand our fellow human beings, so that a person can stand before another with true understanding and judge accordingly. Our various opinions, occupations, and environments divide us in life. The means for establishing peace and love, despite different views, should be deeper insight and knowledge, the Theosophical worldview. Originally it came from those who, by developing their slumbering inner capacities, tried to know more of the world than is possible through the ordinary senses or human intellect. Such people are called initiates, and several different stages of initiation are distinguished. The great founders of the religions were great initiates, for example, the ancient Egyptian priests, as well as Zoroaster, Moses, Plato, and Jesus Christ. They all had a more highly developed soul. They were able to see into the spiritual world that surrounds us in a way similar to the physical. As long as we ourselves do not strive to walk the path of initiation, there is only one way to look into those spiritual worlds, namely through human reason. The world becomes light-filled and clear when penetrated by the human mind. Our knowledge of the world becomes clearer and deeper through the spiritual scientific worldview than through other philosophies. Human reason is the judge over the acceptance or rejection of such teachings. We have a real need for such teachings, which is why they are presented to us. Now, we are to develop our souls ourselves, so that they are again in a position to recognize the higher, supersensible reality that will be described more precisely in what follows. Such development, of course, cannot be a case of should or must. It is unnecessary for everyone to take such a path. Those who are suited will receive the necessary encouragement in due course, and then they will take the appropriate steps. There have always been ways for acquiring these higher abilities. Until recent decades, however, they were known only to a few chosen spiritual teachers and pupils. Anyone called to it can eventually find the appropriate path of development. All that is required is an earnest decision of one's free will. This lecture is not intended to propagandize or to force anyone to follow such a path. The paths that one can follow are to be revealed. The goal of such development is initiation, that is, the acquisition of abilities leading to supersensible knowledge. Unfortunately, the erroneous opinion is widespread that theosophy is something imported from the East, that it in fact originates in India as a new kind of Buddhism that wants to become a new religion forced upon Westerners. This belief does a great injustice to theosophy, for it has also been in Europe from the very beginning. Particularly in the last centuries, it has taken root in many locations. Of course, it has always found more understanding in the East. The East and the West have always had entirely different ways of initiation that correspond to deeper ethnic characteristics. It is more obvious for us to follow the European path, which is more important for us than that of the East. All of these paths lead, of course, to the same goal, since truth is here and there, today and yesterday, and in all eternity the same. The three most important paths of initiation will be described briefly. First, the Indian yoga initiation. Second, the Christian Gnostic path, which can certainly still be followed by modern human beings. And third, the Rosicrucian path, which is the most appropriate for modern human beings who, in the final analysis, cannot find satisfaction in mere faith, but are acquainted with the achievements of modern culture and technology. At its deepest foundation, this is also a Christian path, which can be seen in the fact that someone trained in the Rosicrucian way learns to understand the wisdom teachings of Christianity in the deepest and best sense. We will first consider the Eastern path of yoga. It is possible for the human soul to develop itself so far that it becomes like an eye, EYE, that can see directly the spiritual, eternal, non-temporal. The path of development taken by an individual of the East is different from that taken by a European. Hindus are not only different from Europeans externally, even their brains and souls have different structures. Therefore, it is clear that a Hindu must take a different path than a European to really reach the intended goal. Indeed, the differences are so great that Europeans would ruin themselves morally and physically if they wanted to take the Eastern path of development. The loneliness and withdrawal of the soul from civilization required by the yoga path is almost impossible in our European culture. We would have to step entirely out of our everyday ordinary lives, indeed out of our entire culture, in order to devote ourselves to our own inner development. Those advancing spiritually on this path need a spiritual leader or guru who can lead them safely through the many possible confusions. It is impossible to tread such a path without a guru. Furthermore, it requires a complete transformation of the human being, a transformation prescribed by the guru. Such a guru then possesses altogether an unlimited power over the pupil. It is not a matter of indifference what the human being does in life. It is no longer adequate to be a good, decent human being of the ordinary sort, simply to be a person whom society ordinarily deems exemplary. It must now be possible to completely distinguish and separate body and soul. They must no longer be permitted to interpenetrate as they did earlier. In the future, passions and animal instincts should no longer have to be involved with the soul for as long as they are now. The soul is hindered from penetrating through the fog of the physical world and seeing into the higher spiritual world. However, when soul and body are separated from each other, the body can assert its passions and desires even as the soul is simultaneously located in a higher life. It is possible then for the soul to transform itself to the point of spiritual vision, while the body falls prey to all kinds of wicked traits and possibly perishes because the body's passions and drives are no longer guided to something better by an insightful soul. We see from this the enormous importance of proper guidance on this dangerous path. In every case, the guru must be obeyed, even when one is disinclined. Gurus are permitted to interfere in the most intimate affairs of the heart, and give their pupils corresponding rules for behavior. Certain relationships may be forbidden because they hinder the pupil's development. Prerequisites for such development are, first, effective prevention of the degeneration of the lower instincts, and then constant practice of certain ways of acting, the consolidation of certain characteristics, and the development of capacities slumbering or not yet present. The first prerequisite for taking this path is breaking the habit of frivolous thinking. This may seem easy, but in fact it is very difficult. We are chased by outer impressions. For at least 5 minutes of the day, students should be absolute lord of their train of thought. For example, we could, as an exercise, attempt to hold a single mental picture at the center of consciousness. Nothing must be allowed to connect with this image except what I, through my own free decision, decide to connect with it, no matter how many thoughts involuntarily attach themselves to it. This exercise could be attempted with a variety of objects. Gradually, we acquire greater control of our thoughts, which then manifests in more precise speech. The second goal is initiative in actions. This is lacking almost entirely in some people. From early in life, they are usually forced into an occupation that absorbs most of their conscious actions. Most of our actions are determined from outside. Consequently, those who seek initiation should feel an urgent need to set themselves the task of regularly carrying out at a specific time of day a deed that comes from their own inner initiative, regardless of how insignificant it may be. Third, pupils should get beyond extreme mood swings. They should not surrender their wills in the face of every pain or pleasure, but maintain an inner balance in the face of even the bitterest pain or the greatest pleasure. This certainly does not need to create dullness and insensitivity. On the contrary, such efforts should lead to an even more delicate and intense feeling life. Fourth, a Persian legend concerning Christ should come to life vividly for the students. Jesus was once walking with his disciples where a half-decomposed dog carcass lay on the roadside. It was disgusting to look at. The disciples looked away from it, appalled, but Jesus Christ looked at the carcass with loving eyes and remarked, quote, "Look at the beautiful teeth of this dead animal." Unquote. The message is to seek hidden beauty in what is ugly and altogether to look always for the positive, for that to which one can say, quote, "Yes." Unquote. Even in the life of the worst evildoer, there are light-filled moments that can be met with understanding. Fifth, complete freedom from all prejudice is to be striven for. The past must never be allowed to determine our judgment concerning the present. We must not reject something new simply because we have never encountered it before. We must approach new knowledge without prejudice if we wish to become initiates. The sixth condition is the development of soul harmony. Actually, this requirement should arise by itself from the others. The characteristics listed are indispensable preconditions for everyone taking the yoga path to initiation. The actual yoga path also consists of various aspects, which must be clearly distinguished from one another. First, pupils of yoga should not kill, lie, or steal. Neither should they live a dissolute life, nor desire inordinately. The more we stop living at the expense of others, the closer we come to what is meant by the words, quote, "You shall not steal," unquote. Of course, the criminally punishable form of stealing is not an issue here, but rather a more subtle form. The meaning of the other requirements is obvious to everyone. Second, it is much desired that pupils make certain symbolic actions their own. Pupils are to develop a feeling for and an understanding of cultic actions, because a ritual is actually just a symbolic expression of deeper content. Third, pupils must situate their bodies in a certain way and assume a certain posture, for it is not at all a matter of indifference what position one takes during spiritual exercises toward higher wisdom. The body should be brought into line with the direction of the spiritual streams in the world. Fourth, pranayama, or the breathing in yoga, is of great importance because it is connected with the requirement not to kill. For with our breath we exert a deadly effect on many things in our surroundings. Yoga breathing has as its goal the elimination of any deadly influence from human breath upon other living creatures. Above all, not as much deadly carbonic acid should be produced. We can see that this is possible from the fact that those deeply initiated on this path can spend decades in stale caves without experiencing physical ruin. The fifth step is concerned with the suppression of certain sensory images. We are no longer permitted to allow every sensory image and thought to work upon us. We should rather select specific ones in order then to concentrate all our attention on them. Moreover, the other thoughts should be given a specific and regulated path to follow through our minds. The sixth stage in the process requires the pupil to concentrate on a light impression that has remained in the soul. The latter constitutes an even higher stage. Even more valuable is a meditation that arises from a mental image that no longer belongs to the sensory world. It is absolutely essential to their training that individuals devote themselves to such images in contemplation. The seventh step is very difficult, for it consists in this, that the pupils banish any and all thoughts and images from their consciousness altogether, yet nevertheless remain completely awake and alert. In this way they approach a condition of intuitive receptivity. Only then is the ground prepared for content to flow into them from a world hitherto unknown. Through all this preparation and training, the guru is indispensable, for only through him or her, and exclusively through him or her, are these inner processes guided in the proper way for the good of the pupil. The description of the yoga path presented here is, of course, only an incomplete sketch, and not in any way intended to serve as a guide for following the path. Once again, let it be said that this path requires the necessary guidance of a guru, which can be conveyed only personally from one human being to another. The second path is the Christian Gnostic. The primary distinction between this path and the previous one is that it does not require that every individual pupil have a special guru. This requirement is removed because of the existence of a great personality, Jesus Christ, who should be the goal and guide on the path. A more precise description of this path is found in Holy Scripture, the Bible, especially in John's Gospel, which in its depths is a direct set of instructions for mystical training. On this path, the leader is more an advisor than an actual authoritarian guru. Guidance toward initiation here includes at the same time the highest authority, Jesus Christ. John's Gospel gives this guidance toward mystical initiation. It is thus not a book to study, but a book to live. Even the first few sentences of this Gospel have a certain mystical power and are extremely important for progress on the path of initiation. A Christian student of the mysteries must have a meditative relationship with these few sentences. For example, this means shaping these sentences and nothing else into the content of one's soul every morning at a specified time. After a time, the deep contents of these sentences become intuitively clear. Only then has the moment come when further study of John's Gospel can really begin to bear fruit. In the course of this study, pictures from the Gospel will gradually slip into our dreams, so that we ourselves inwardly experience the actions portrayed therein. This inner experience is then extended over all stages of development, a more detailed description of which I cannot provide here. The first step of Christian mystical development, the washing of the feet, is a symbolic action for the humble confession of our dependence upon what is lower than we are, for the fact that we have come forth from what stands below us. Certain external symptoms appear when we have reached this stage, a peculiar sensation of water running over our feet. The inner sign is the appearance of the imaginative picture of the washing of the feet. The second stage is the scourging, which is also experienced as a feeling. It means that we must always stand upright and not become faint-hearted, despite the great pain and numerous worries that we must bear in life. Here, too, we have an inner as well as an outer sign. namely a peculiar stinging sensation and a spiritual picture of our own scourging. The third stage is the crowning with thorns. This experience tells us that we should not lose our inner firmness, our inner balance, even when we encounter great pain, even when our most sacred feelings and convictions are persecuted with derision and mockery. Symptoms of this stage include aches and pains in the head, and a vision of oneself with a crown of thorns on the head. The fourth stage is the bearing of the cross. Here the pupil should have the experience that the body is actually an object of indifference compared with the soul and the soul's importance. If we are really conscious of this fact, then we will also be able to use the body merely as an instrument for higher purposes. Then we will really be master of the body. The signs are the appearance of Christ's wounds as red spots on the hands and feet. Of course, these blood spots appear only for a few moments during meditation. The pupil has also an inner vision of being crucified. The fifth stage is mystical death. Here the pupils experience the whole world around them as if it were covered by a veil. They sense dimly that essential reality lies behind the veil. While feeling themselves to be in this darkness, the veil suddenly tears, and they can see into an entirely new and wonderful world. They learn to judge in an entirely different way what lies at the foundation of the human soul. This mystical death is like a descent into hell. Now the pupils are awakened and can proceed to the sixth stage, placement in the grave. Human beings at this point experience their entire external surroundings as their own body. The personality expands and embraces the whole earth. The body feels itself one with the earth, and personal consciousness expands to a consciousness of the earth. The seventh stage cannot be described more exactly because it is entirely beyond our ordinary ability to form sensory images. It can, at best, be comprehended by those who through an unceasing exercise have finally freed themselves from this world. This stage includes entrance to perfect godliness and glory, which words are inadequate to describe. This Christian path is very difficult because it is inwardly connected with great humility and total self-sacrifice. However, those who follow it to the end achieve what is the goal and dignity of humanity. True Christianity has really come alive within them. The Rosicrucian path is the third way. This path is actually only a modification of the other two. It came about in the 14th century because the adepts of that time saw that cultural conditions would be entirely different in the coming centuries. This is the most suitable path for a modern human being. It is also the most appropriate for a European. This is not to say that one of the other paths could not also lead to the goal. However, the Rosicrucian system is the most compatible with our whole culture and civilization. It is also true that this path has, until now, not been set forth in books or manuscripts, but has been passed on orally from one generation to another. A detailed presentation of it is found in the magazine Lucifer Gnosis under the title, quote, How Does One Attain Knowledge of the Higher Worlds? Unquote, footnote revised and expanded as How to Know Higher Worlds, A Modern Path of Initiation. Collected Works, Volume 10, end of footnote. We find here an entirely different understanding of the role of the guru, who is no longer an absolute authority, but more of an advisor and friend. Here, authority is simply a free individual decision. Development takes place in seven stages. Study, imagination, knowledge of the esoteric script, the rhythmizing of life, a search for relationships between macrocosm and microcosm, contemplation, and experience of divine blessedness. First of all, study is required, not of course study in the scholarly sense, but rather an engagement with thoughts about the world and human life, about the origin of the stars, and so on. Other kinds of thought training are also possible. Thinking is able to provide new experiences that is only goal-oriented logical thinking. It becomes a reliable guide through all worlds, for in each we must think consistently in the same way. Second is the acquisition of imagination. It consists in this, that we achieve a moral relationship to our surroundings, and not just a theoretical thinking relationship. We should learn to perceive a moral background behind everything. To cultivate this imagination, we can, for example, imagine a plant with perfect clarity before our eyes. Or we can place a seed before us and imagine the gradual rising up of a blade and finally a mature plant with fruit. With enough exercise, one can see how a plant emerges from a seed and grows upward. That requires, of course, very strong esoteric powers. With modest means, however, one can perceive the astral body of the plant like a small flame that emerges from the plant. The third step is learning the esoteric script. This consists in the acquisition of signs and symbols that are connected with world processes. The fourth consideration is giving rhythm to one's life. This step involves regulating one's breathing so that the relationship between exhaled carbon dioxide and inhaled oxygen is altered in a certain way. It is altogether necessary to bring rhythm into our lives in this restless age. All processes follow one another in a great rhythm, and this rhythm should be carried into life as much as possible. For example, one should assign meditation to an exact specified hour, or hold the rukshau, or backward viewing of one's foregoing day and life at the same hour in the evening. In this way, powerful forces are released in the soul. The fifth step involves seeking correspondence between microcosm and macrocosm. Goethe expressed the connection between these two in these beautiful words, quote, "Were the eye not already sun-like, it could never see the sun. If God's own power did not reside in us, how could we ever be delighted by what is divine?" Unquote. A thorough immersion in meditation upon our own organs teaches us about that part of the macrocosm that corresponds to them. For example, studying the eye, Y-E, teaches us about light, and researching the lungs gives us information concerning the composition of air, and so forth. In this way, we ultimately arrive at self-knowledge. Through immersion in the inner micro-world, the macro-world is gradually revealed. The state of divine blessedness is finally achieved through such comparative observations and as a consequence of all the previous exercises, especially the deep, tranquil contemplation of the sixth stage. Through all these steps, it is necessary for the pupil to be permeated by certain beneficial characteristics: trust in oneself, self-mastery, and presence of mind. This inner training is to be worked on continuously. For, although the divine is already latent within us, it is not directly revealed without work and corresponding development. This path does not require any kind of sequestering away from society and other human beings in order to devote oneself to one's inner development in loneliness. Neither does it require any contempt for matter, merely arising above and overcoming it on the way to something higher. Quote, "Self-knowledge is knowledge of the world," unquote, will serve as our motto. The three paths described lead us to a higher pupilship. Only from this perspective can we acquire, through a genuine initiate, the last key to the secrets of the world, in order to thereby receive insight into the deeper connections of the life of the world and human beings. The highest stage, then, comprehends the capacity to receive intuitions from higher worlds. It is a state of spiritual brightness and divine light. The end of Lecture 4.1.